Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Today we have part four of our John Frusciante Returns series. This is the latest installment of Rick Rubin's ongoing series of in-depth interviews with the Red Hot Chili Peppers guitarist. And if this is the first interview you're hearing, make sure to go back and check out the first three parts and also John's appearance from earlier in the year promoting Unlimited Love. Today, we'll hear John Frusciante play through some more of his guitar parts. Then he'll explain how he came up with some of the best guitar melodies in modern rock history. John also talks about how playing along to classic heavy metal albums from Black Sabbath and Van Halen, along with dancing all night at drum and bass clubs, helped shape his style on the 2002 album, By the Way. He also explains how listening to Brandy, Destiny's Child, and Wu-Tang Clan helped influence his playing on Stadium Arcadium. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's part four of Rick Rubin with John Frusciante from Shangri-La.
So over the course of touring for Californication, did you feel like you came back guitar-wise to where you could play like you could before in terms of your strength and skill?
I did, but when it came time to record By the Way, I didn't want to go back to that kind of Jimi Hendrix-y way of playing.
The style changed.
Yeah, like I wanted to go even further with what I felt were the real developments on Californication. I was really into 60s music at the time. I was really into surf guitar style. Like I'd learned about certain things because I played a bit that way on Californication, mainly being inspired by the guy from Bow Wow Wow and stuff. But I guess Johnny had shown me the Ventures and stuff. And then Jerry from Fugazi showed me the Shadows, which I didn't know about. And Johnny wasn't super familiar with either. And they were really good. It was just like an English version of surf guitar music.
And they were really popular in England from, you know, all the Beatles stories I hear.
Yeah, well, especially because they were Cliff Richard's backing band and he was the biggest rock and roll.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was the biggest English rock and roll thing before the Beatles. So, that was just Hank Marvin, his guitar player, sort of had his side thing was Hank Marvin and the Shadows. And they were huge. Like they were an instrumental band and they were like, they were one of the biggest things in England for the, with the kids before the Beatles. So I got really into learning all, while we were touring for Californication, I got really into learning how to play all the Shadows stuff and playing along with the Ventures all the time. And I was seeing the commonality between that surf guitar sense of melody and synth pop sense of melody. Yeah. To me, they have something in common. And so for when we started writing for By the Way, I think I just, I didn't want to have any blues in my playing. Like if Flea brought in something that seemed bluesy to me, even in a funk way, I didn't like it. Like it wasn't so much I was trying to control Flea or anything. I just really didn't like anything that had that feeling. It was like just at that time where I had landed.
Really great blues song on the new album, by the way.
Right. Carry Me Home.
Yeah.
The working title was New Blues, as you remember.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, right after that on Stadium Arcadium, I was really into blues and and I had a new take on it by that time. Like by that time, I was playing along with Jimi Hendrix a lot and learning his improvised solos a lot, like in a more detailed way than I'd ever learned them in my whole life. I was listening to a lot of modern R&B at the time. So I was listening to like Destiny's Child and Brandy. Brandy was my favorite. And her sense of rhythm and her sense of melody, that blues, the blues that's in that, I felt like I want to take that feeling and combine it with Jimi Hendrix's guitar playing style, like to have Brandy be my basic reference rather than like, you know, Elmore James or whatever, old things, you know. It made it feel fresh to me. Like, and I was doing a lot of the, what we were talking about last time where you're not playing straight across the bar. You're not on a grid. You're not on a 16th note grid. You're kind of speeding up and slowing down and playing. Cause she was singing like that and really good. And Method Man was, Wu-Tang in general was rapping like that, especially on their first couple of records. And so like, I was like obsessing on all that music and feeling like I got to put this kind of rhythm in my solos and in my playing and stuff. So like there were times where I was like, because of the Frank Zappa, you know, education, like there's one song, We Believe on that album, Stadium Arcadium. And like, I'm, for a lot of the reverse guitar part, I'm playing quintuplets. I'm playing 5 against 4, but I'm doing it in this way that I'm hearing on rap records. Cause when they're doing it, they just have 5 words and they're going to land on the one on the next bar.
That's fine.
The 6th word.
Yeah.
And so like, as long as you land, as long as you punctuate what you're doing on the one, you can fit any amount of notes in between. And that's what I was hearing in a lot of this R&B and rap. So that's what sort of got my excitement about incorporating blues into the band again. That's what got me excited about it.
Because it was a new version of the blues. It was a way that it hadn't been played before.
Yeah. So that started with By the Way, where like, and when By the Way started, I had all these ideas for these certain types of melodic things. And I was learning more about chords than ever because I'm practicing piano for the first time in my life out of songbooks. So, and that was affecting the way that I played guitar because I'm seeing chords more clearly than I'd ever seen them before. Understanding the Beatles music better than I'd ever understood it before. And yeah, continuing to listen to the synth pop, also going out to drum and bass clubs to dance every week. So the song By the Way was the result of having been at a club the night before playing drum and bass and sometimes jungle.
Would going out dancing inspire the way you played guitar?
Exactly. Like
how would that work?
Well, the song at the end of that album, Venice Queen.
Yeah.
The way I'm just trying to play guitar. I mean, it's not like it's a way that nobody ever played the guitar. I don't know if I can do it justice right now. I'm not super warmed up, but
that's okay.
But just
for the idea.
But the song has a whole intro that's slower, but then it has a fast part that comes in. And the rhythms I'm doing on the guitar, if you listen to it, it sounds like a jungle drummer, like improvising. Like it sounds like the kind of stuff people were programming then, like.
So what's particularly interesting about that is the right hand, I imagine, unusual.
Yeah, the right hand. I'm basically, there's more parts to it than that. Where, let's see if I remember the chords. Where I'm going even more. But.
Thank you.
So like the way I'm playing there is definitely, I'm trying to play the way I hear the drums at the drum and bass club, you know?
Yeah.
Chad's kind of just going, poom, he's not really doing a lot of ghost snares that I can tell, but I'm trying to play all those kind of rhythms that
it's
a lot of the time
really
would be
cool
on the snare.
And because it's the chords are, I can say it's an ordinary chord progression. It's cool. It's a cool ordinary chord progression, but the rhythm makes it sound like very new,
right,
and very different,
right?
And like it has a Who-like energy, but you never hear Pete Townsend playing a rhythm like that,
right? Yeah, like that would be a good comparison, but yeah, not that precise rhythm. It wouldn't be that.
No, you know? It sounds almost like a programmed rhythm.
Right. Yeah. So that was a big influence on it. And
what's cool about that, like I never knew that.
Right.
But it always sounded interesting to me. I never knew why.
Right.
But it's like, this doesn't sound like the Who. You know, there's something else going on. I never stopped to analyze what it was.
Yeah.
But hearing how it happened is fascinating.
Yeah. Because I would go, it was on Thursday nights, there was this club, Concrete Jungle in Silver Lake. So I would go there and dance all night. There was this girl who used to go there with me. And yeah, I'd just be dancing. So when I get to rehearsal, like I'd want to put that kind of energy into the into the band a lot of the time. That was just the rhythms that were going through my head. But when we started the record, there was another side to it. Like I wanted to do, like I was really into the Damned at the time.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do punk, like in a way that the band hadn't done it, you know, like I wanted to do real punk, you know, like inspired by like early English punk and stuff. And so I thought we would do my original concept was that we would have like these 60s inspired melodic songs. I was really into Discharge as well, I remember. And we would have
Discharge.
Like sort of straight punk, not straight, I don't know what you call it, but just like real punk as opposed to punk inspired pop.
Yes.
Like I wanted to do like actual, I was writing songs that to me sounded like actual punk. So I thought the album would have this like, you know, stark contrast between really pretty things and these punk things. And at a certain point you said to me, the punk things that you're bringing in, they're good, but it sounds like I feel like I've heard it before. These melodic things that you're bringing in, I feel like I've never heard anything like it in my life.
Yeah.
You know? So you definitely like guided me away from continuing in the pretty early on, as I remember it. But we had written a bunch of stuff. Like there was a certain amount of,
yeah, I really loved The Damned, and maybe it was just like, I feel like I've heard this before, but yeah. I've had that feeling before, you know, like I didn't really get Guns N' Roses because I felt like I already experienced this.
Right.
This doesn't feel new to me.
But a neat thing to me about that album is that kind of what we were talking about the chords or this implied thing that's underneath, but
yeah.
What Flea and I are playing over them is something that's separate from that. That's how it was with musical styles for that album. Like to me, there is a punk energy there in the record, despite that we're never going in that sort of distorted, you know, like obviously punk direction. And at the same time, another sort of underlying aspect was that every time there was a day of rehearsal that Flea and Anthony couldn't go for whatever reason, maybe there was a game or one of them was busy with something, so we were supposed to not rehearse that day. Chad was always up for rehearsing anyways. So me and Chad, from time to time throughout the writing of that record, would get together. I'd just say to him, let's play the whole first Black Sabbath album. And me and him would just go there, and all he needs to do to learn how to play a record is listen to it while he's driving in his car on the way, you know.
And then he can just play it.
He can just play it. It's the fact that it's drums. There's only so many drums. All he has to do is listen to it to be able to play it.
Yeah.
Like for guitar, you have to do a little more like work. So we would play whole albums of Black Sabbath, Van Halen, and Ozzy Osbourne. We were doing Die of a Madman, or at least we were doing a bunch of the songs from that and Blizzard of Oz, but it was just guitar and drums, but we were doing these heavy metal rehearsals of Deep Purple as well. We were doing the whole album of Machine Head, whole album of In Rock.
Great.
Like, so we would just pick an album and we'd show up and we'd just play that whole album, not straight through. Like sometimes we'd have to stop so I could explain the arrangement. No, it does this part for this long or whatever it is, because he hasn't focused on it how I have. But like, but we'd get through the whole album of all those things. And when I hear that album, I hear that in the connection of Chad and Mai's playing, like it's in there. It's not, there's no real heavy metal on the album, but it's not an album by people who can't play heavy metal. What I mean?
Like,
like Chad and I were really dialed into it at the time. I always feel like it's cool to have things like that. I feel
it seems like if you're good at any aspect, even if it's not being demonstrated, it makes what you're doing better. Has to.
Right.
It has to. And it has, not only does it have to make it better, but it informs it in some way that you, that can't be explained.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. I feel like it's magical to have things that you can do that you're not throwing on the surface for people to see.
Yeah.
The way I play on that album, it's a real synth pop based, new wave based, surf guitar based style. Yet at home, I was playing along with Van Halen and playing those solos. Like I was probably never as good at playing Eddie Van Halen's stuff as I was at the time of By the Way.
Yeah, and, the album's nothing like that.
There's not a hint of that in the way that I play.
Yeah.
I feel like it's in there still.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
There's a certain confidence between the way that I'm playing those simple things that I'm playing, and a certain precision in the accenting of things and in the rhythm playing. It's a lot of things that I got from his style that just aren't the obvious, you know, frontal parts of his style. So, yeah, I think it adds a magic to things when there's something hidden.
Yeah. What I remember as my favorite song on that album, although I don't remember and I haven't listened in a while, is that Universally Speaking song on that album, isn't it? I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
And that one has just a, it doesn't sound like any other Chili Pepper song. And it definitely sounds like it's rooted in, you know, maybe early 60s music more than late 50s music.
Yeah. I was just watching something that made a comparison between two things that Universally fits into. Okay. So they were talking about the first song on Brian Eno's album, Here Come the Warm Jets. It goes,
don't let it show. And the drums are going tick, 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 tick.
And then Waiting for My Man. It's the same rhythm, basically. When you put the I saw it on YouTube, somebody had put those two things next to each other, and they said, look, the Eno song is obviously inspired by the Velvet Underground song. And Universally Speaking, I don't know if I'd made the connection to the Eno thing, but I was trying to do something like Velvet Underground. I thought we should have something that's just like a straight rhythm. All our songs have these funky kind of syncopated kind of rhythms to them. Like, that would be cool if we had a song that just had a real straight rhythm to it like that. So I don't, you know, I don't remember specifically what song, but it is the same type of rhythm as Waiting for the Man.
Really interesting. So I don't hear Velvet Underground in it at all.
Right.
At all.
Yeah. But yeah, for in ours, it was a, that's partially like coming, I was definitely trying to do something that was a Velvet Underground type groove. What I saw amazing. As being their type of groove.
Yeah.
And it's that
and
same
it also drum the drum beat, if I remember correctly, is more like a Motown. It's like a,
I think you might have added the drum beat.
Might have. But it's definitely different than everything else we ever did. It's a really unique song.
Right.
And I think we might have oboes on it too. Or bassoons.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really cool orchestra stuff.
Yeah, that was inspired by Sonny and Cher.
Right.
From my perspective, it was just like, oh, there's a sound on Sonny and Cher, so I never heard it on anything else. Like, maybe we can get that instrument.
That's so cool, because I remember specifically trying to do a Velvet, like thinking it should be a straight rhythm like the Velvet Underground. But I also remember you being the one who suggested that drum beat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I would have known we were going for Velvet Underground, I wouldn't have suggested
but
that.
That's so the drum beat.
Yeah, that's what's so cool about it. Is it as well?
Well, that's what I was saying, is that the wow. Eno song has that drum beat of Universally Speaking.
Wow.
Waiting for the Man has that drum beat.
Wow. And
So all three of those songs have that beat.
Yeah. I have a feeling everyone got it from Motown, is my guess.
Yeah, you're right.
Even though everything comes from the Velvet Underground, like everything else comes from Velvet Underground.
No, but the Motown comes before that.
But that beat probably comes from Motown.
Yeah, you know, totally. And that's really what Lou Reed wished he was a soul singer, I think. Anyways, I think I've heard him say.
I remember Anthony sang that song different than all the other songs, too.
Yeah.
He sang in a lower key than he normally sings, like a bassy voice.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting record.
I know. There's so many surprises. When I listen to that record, like after having not heard it for a long time, I'm like, whoa, how the fuck did I do that? I didn't know anything about synthesizers. How did I do that?
So cool.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more from Rick and John after the break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market, and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with more from Rick Rubin and John Frusciante.
I think there's something really fun about putting on instruments you don't know how to play.
Yeah.
Do you know, like it's the same reason that the first version of a new style of music is interesting. It's because the person who's making it doesn't even really know what it is yet.
Yeah, you're in the process of figuring it out. You can never beat that.
No,
you
know? It's like, so exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good argument to always like pick up a different instrument and just get sounds out of it.
Yeah. It's my understanding that David Bowie, when he record records, he'd have the person still trying to figure this out what to play, and he'd stop them at the point where they were just about to figure it out. That's when he'd stop them. Like, he'd be like, that's when he caught what he wanted to catch. He doesn't want
before
the sound.
Before they figured it out.
Right before they figured it out.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't want the sound of it once they're confident with it. He wants it just as it's just becoming clear to them.
Yeah.
That's the groove that he wanted to hear, you know? So he'd often stop people like before they felt,
I think they'd only done like one or two takes. Often would play a song once or maybe twice before, and no one else in the room had ever heard the song before.
Yeah.
So like you'd played along whatever sounded right and that would be it.
Yeah. But again, like aside from the Velvet Underground, like that groove of where that the guitar is generally doing for a lot of that song, like where you're going hard, soft. The Ramones, like, they have that in their music, like, over and over. It's a lot of fast downstrokes, but a lot of the time...
Where are these chords coming from? Because these are really interesting chords, though.
You know, you do...
Tell me about the chords.
That?
Universally, yeah.
You know, I was just playing along with the Beatles a lot and learning all their songs and feeling more free with chord progressions than I'd ever felt. Like previously, the stuff that I'd done on like Blood Sugar and Californication, it felt more like formulas that I knew that chord progression works. It's in a lot of songs. Mm-hmm. This chord progression works. It's mm-hmm. in a lot of songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This was where, by the way, I'm starting to sort of create chord progressions from scratch. Sort of there's not a template. It's not a formula. It's almost like I started seeing chords as harmonies rather than chord progressions mm-hmm. per se. So I'm seeing it as a certain kind of harmonic movement, and I'm starting to do interesting what's called modulations, where like when I'm doing this, you're basically like in an A major thing. We're still in an A major thing. But when I go, that chord is unexpected. That's all of a sudden it has a B minor feel to it when I go to that G chord. I haven't even gone to the B minor chord, but all of a sudden you get a minor, even though it's a major chord that I've gone to, you get a minor feeling when it goes to that G. I'm starting to figure out things like that doing these kind of I was starting to see these patterns that they used in classical music and stuff, but comprehending what the idea was, not taking somebody else's pattern, but seeing, oh, I see, I can, instead of thinking of it as chords, I can think of it as just general harmonic movement.
Yeah. The first two of the chords are the bram, bram, is also, I never heard it in the song, but hearing it just like that played slowly, it reminds me of the chords in the Led Zeppelin song. I don't know the name of the song. Pran, pran, pran-a-na-na-na-na-na-na, pran, 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 pran.
I think he's in a different tuning in that song, so I can't play it. But like I was just playing along with a couple of Beatles songs that I would put in this category, that And Your Bird Can Sing.
Yep.
Like so it cool. Sounds like it's going to be one of those when you hear the first two chords. It sounds like it's going. It's not the same two chords exactly, but that idea of where
Where you feel where it's moving.
Down.
It's descending in a form that we're expecting.
Yeah. And then, but then that G to B minor changes it. So, mm-hmm. but yeah, that Led Zeppelin song.
Oh, I remember seeing a YouTube video where a guy is taking apart one of your guitar parts and he's saying that you purposely detuned one of, not that you changed the tuning, but you detuned one string slightly, and that's the only way to play the song. That anyone who plays the song plays it wrong because the secret is detuning. Is that possible? Is that true?
It wasn't done consciously. I just was out of tune. Yeah, it's scar tissue that's about. My guitar tech told me about that.
It was a fascinating video.
Right. Yeah. I guess you're gonna sound a little. I get that all the time when I play along with old blues records.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, like electric blues players,
you think what they're playing is
from
slightly
the 50s
differently.
And 60s. No, you just have to tune your guitar to it because each one of their strings is tuned a little different. Like Albert King and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
When you're learning a song, you gradually figure out, okay, his E string is here. You just try to match the strings for it to sound like it's not, for it to not rub.
Yeah.
So in that case, I guess one of my strings was a little out of tune and it sounded good. So nobody ever said, like, you would have been sent, if it hadn't sounded good, you would have been
sensitive.
I would have
been the first one.
Yeah. But like, clearly, like, it sounded good. Cause you know, like on synthesizers, like on the DX7, you can do these micro tunings where you can have like a different amount of notes to the octave. You know, you can have, you know, whatever, 19 notes to the octave or something. And so you have notes in between what the normal 12 notes that we all use. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good expression in there by using these notes that are in between, if they're exactly in between in a precise kind of way. And so I guess I was out of tune in a way that really worked, you know, because that doesn't sound out of tune to me. But
yeah, it doesn't sound out of tune to me either. Yeah. Interesting. Next time I listen to Scar Tissue, I'll listen for that.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember what song it was, but the guy really went in depth. It was a good, it's so interesting. People who get into stuff who can look at it in a much deeper way from the outside than, you know, you weren't aware of, you made it and you weren't aware of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wanted to point out that a lot of the time, like, as we're talking about these things where something was the source of, I remember it as being the source of something. A lot of the time it was usually because I'm playing along with so many different things at the time. I'll see a few songs that have all the same thing in it in some way. Maybe it's in a different key. Maybe it's, you know, but I'll see some theoretical sort of theme that a couple of songs have in common. And I'll just be like, oh, that's cool. Those have that in common. I'm going to write one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, it's a lot of the time, and I might remember it as
one,
being one, but a lot
but
of the time
be,
it's more
oh,
than
you
one.
You see it in three different songs, like, oh, I wonder what.
Yeah. And a lot of the time, because I notice it, like that thing you're talking about, where you're going, like, I'm noticing, I start thinking, like, I must be noticing it for a reason. I must be supposed to write something like that.
Yeah.
Because it's generally the way my brain works.
Yeah, me too. Like, I feel like if you hear the same thing three times, it's like,
yeah.
Somebody wants me to know this information.
Yeah, exactly.
Should we look at some guitar parts and some songs from the new albums?
Sure.
Be fun.
Sure.
Let's do newest album first. We'll work backwards.
Okay. Hopefully I remember.
The first one I noticed was on my little list was Eddie.
Well, Eddie just, Flea came up. Flea came in with the bass line, and I just started playing that melody. The part I wrote in that song is the bridge.
It's still interesting to talk about how you hear what Flea's playing and what you choose to play is fascinating, because I don't think anyone else would play what you played.
Right.
It's just as interesting.
Yeah, he came in with that bass line, and I came in with the melody.
Do you remember what the bass line does?
I know what the tonality of it is.
Yeah.
Like Like, but I don't know. And it's I can't play the actual bass line, but that's the basic.
That also sounds more like a guitar part than a bass line.
Because I'm playing, I'm making up a guitar part that's the chords. I know what he's doing basically implies an F7, a G6, and an A minor.
I see.
Like, I don't know what he's playing.
I understand.
One time we did a sound check where Flea played guitar and I played bass.
Yeah.
And we played Chili Peppers songs.
Yeah.
It was so funny.
I bet it was great.
It was terrible.
They were completely different songs.
We didn't know. No, like we tried to play each other's parts based on our conception, weak conception of what the other one's doing.
Yeah.
And neither of us had any idea what the other was doing. It was really comical.
It's kind of cool though. Yeah.
You know, it's my understanding that in the Police, they all knew how to play all the parts. They could have switched instruments and done a show. Maybe that's just a fake.
I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing.
I thought it was pretty neat, just that they're that inside. The songs are, I don't know, just weave together in this way that they're simpler than our songs for sure. But like, I thought that was cool that somebody would know it. But like, I'm incapable of playing bass like Flea. Flea's incapable of playing guitar like me. So we have a sort of a vague idea of what the other one's doing, you know. We're good at listening to each other, but we can't play like each other.
Yeah, and I love the way you can complete each other's thoughts in, like in this example, Flea came in with the bass line, and what you played with it is not, again, I don't believe it would be what anyone else would play, and that combination is what makes it sound like the Chili Peppers, you know?
Yeah.
And the same, when you come in with something, what he chooses to do, never seems like the regular thing.
Yeah. So Eddie Van Halen, we just found out that he died, I guess, that morning or the night before or something. And then that was our first rehearsal. And that was something Flea happened to have written. So that was what was on all
our minds. It on bass or did he write it on piano?
Bass. And yeah, again, the verse, I think we're again doing that kind of thing where we're in harmony to each other. If you heard just my guitar part, it wouldn't sound like the song.
It doesn't sound like the song, right?
But
it sounds like
I was kind of thinking of part Fugazi.
So part of the orchestration of the song.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess Fugazi must have had a certain amount of things like that because that verse part reminds me of Fugazi, just that when they would sometimes do these sort of soft sections. I don't know. That's what I was thinking of when I was making the guitar part to that. I guess I'm just doing that same thing that Flea and I have done a bunch, you know?
Well, I feel like it's part of this. It's like, in some ways, it's become the sound of the band, even though it's still something it's a jump off point for it to do a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But it's a specific thing that you guys do that I don't hear anyone else do.
Right.
In the same way, like Depeche Mode has a sound that could be part of the Chili Pepper sound is the way that the bass notes and the guitar notes harmonize together to create a chord that is implied, but nobody's playing it.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what we're doing there. And we just needed a bridge, so I think there was a face-off for a bridge. And
do you remember what it was?
No, I just it's the bridge to the song.
Oh, but
I just had that idea.
I don't remember what it is.
We would just all start by doing hits all together, go. So,
you have any idea of why that occurred to you coming out of what it's coming out of?
Yeah. It just seemed like the song had such a nice flowy thing. So I thought what would be good for a bridge? I was thinking of Black Sabbath, even though there's no distortion or anything, obviously. Yeah.
But contrast, the way that they would have
going,
a new...
Bum! But to have the whole band do those hits together and leave these big spaces, I just thought that was like a Sabbath-y kind of thing to do. Which is weird that was what I was thinking because I really wasn't listening to Sabbath while we were, for some reason, that's like all the records since Californication, I was always listening to Sabbath. Like these two albums, I wasn't listening to them. Just Ozzy, I was playing along with sometimes the first two Ozzy albums, but like, I can't think of what song of theirs that does that. But yeah, I just thought like have something where the whole band is punctuating this chord progression, doing them as stabs all together And then for the second half of the bridge, play it as a groove instead of stabs.
Cool. And it's cool that the idea of looking for contrast in a song, that the most interesting thing that you can do in the middle of a song that needs another part is not necessarily the thing that obviously goes with what came before it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. To do something different. Like, and it's also, as I listen to these chords by themselves, like, I knew that if Flea was playing the roots of those chords, yeah, like that these chords would sound good. They sound pretty like partial. Like, it sounds strange to have that open string there, but with the bass, it ties it all together, you know, like, I had a feeling that it would, you know. Also probably sounds weird on acoustic, but.
Bella.
So yeah, there's a song, well, basically Flea came in with the verse to Bella, and it'd be cool if I could find this, but. So this is a song by a group called Black Heat. And 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The it's a really cool funk groove, and it's in 7/4, which is like, and Flea came in one, and that's just something that I'm into because I collect that kind of music, and like, I thought that was, you know, a cool song. But Flea came in with a funk groove, and he didn't realize it was in 7/4.
I was going to say, if you didn't count it, I wouldn't have realized that was in 7/4.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because it's
seamless. It's such a good groove, yeah. And so Flea came in with something in 7/4, and I immediately thought of that song. I was like, oh, this is great. Like, we can do a funk song in 7. And so worked that out with the drums. Like, I've made a lot of my electronic music in 7/4, and my friend Aaron who I make electronic music with, has made a ton of music in 7/4. So it's real familiar to me at this point. Like, aside from being into progressive rock when I was growing up, like, in the last 12 years, I've spent a lot of time in that time signature. So I was showing Flea, like, well, see, there's two main ways that you can break this up. It can be a bar of 4 and a bar of 3, but how I hear this groove is that it should be a bar of 3 and a bar of 4. Like,
I see.
The drums, like, being like, 1, I don't know if I can play it and say it, but 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4.
So cool.
Yeah, so it's just that's why, like, nothing sounds weird about it, because 3 sounds pretty natural to people, 4 sounds pretty natural to people. It's just the two ones next to each other, they just happen to add up to 7, you know?
Yeah.
So we had that groove, and then the chorus came from just doing a face-off, and yeah, I just went in the other room.
This may be one of the ones, there's somewhere, like, I don't understand the musical underpinnings. Like, I didn't know that it was 7/4. And I know then when I was working with Anthony on the vocals, there were some cases where it's like, for the sake of the vocal, we would try to shorten something. And if, when you try to do an edit and it's not the way you think it is,
yeah,
it creates havoc. but we didn't know it going in, because it doesn't sound like a weird groove. It sounds like, yeah, very straightforward.
Yeah.
Until you try editing it based on, oh, the vocal's going to continue hanging, and it pauses, and then we come into the chorus. Can't do it. You know, like, it just, it goes crazy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense, because it seems so normal.
Right.
Until you try changing it.
Right. So, yeah. So, and that's the same way that Black Heat song is. Their chorus is in 4/4. Like, the rest of their songs in 4/4. It's just that verse groove that's in 7. And that's the way our song wound up being as well. So really, you know, Flea hadn't heard the Black Heat song. I just knew it. It just, the second I heard him come in with a funk thing in 7/4, I just thought of that song. And yeah, so it might be kind of hard to play on this guitar, but
was it obvious to you that in the chorus, there's a A half and a B half, that the B half would be the lower half instead of starting with the B half and then doing the A half?
You mean the vocal?
No, in what you just played.
No, it's just the intonation's not great, but... Oh, yeah, that's the way I do it. It's like... Is that what you're talking about?
I think so.
Right. I'm just, you know, I think ever since By the Way Time, like when I write chord progressions, I'm thinking of it as almost as if it were voices in harmony. Like, so it's... there's a melody a lot of the time in there that's being implied, you know? Like when I play that solo at the end,
yeah.
I'm just playing what I hear as being the melody that's already implied in the chord progression.
I see.
It's just you're hearing it with other notes so you don't hear it the same way. But one of the ways that heavy metal, you know, Eddie Van Halen playing wound up influencing By the Way was because... there's a lot of chords on there where I'm doing really difficult stretches to do everything I'm trying to do between the chord and the melody that's weaving in and out of the chord. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of stuff that's like challenging guitar wise. If somebody who doesn't play guitar heard it, or even somebody who does play guitar, you might not think of it as something that sounds difficult to play, but it's actually a really awkward stretch, which Eddie Van Halen was known for, but it sounds like he's doing a big stretch because he's doing sort of fancy lead playing and stuff. But so to me, that chord progression is just sort of me hearing chords more like a group of melodies as opposed to a chord progression. So like if you broke it down, it's a pretty simple common chord progression, but between the ways that I'm inverting the chords and the fact that Flea's playing notes in the bass that wouldn't normally be the notes that the bass would do on those chords. A person with a good ear for chords like me wouldn't necessarily know what they're hearing Inversions are the thing that sort of, an inversion meaning you turn the chord around, the lowest note in the name of the chord isn't the lowest note in the chord anymore. Some other note is the lowest note. So it throws your ear off.
So it's like sliding, let's say, half an octave. If you could play a chord in one octave or you could play it in an octave up, you're playing it in between those two.
In between, exactly. So like, and so consequently with that kind of thinking, you can do, you can play chords that are actually far apart, but play them so they sound like they're right next to each other. So like if I went, that actual, if you went by the chord name and just played the roots in the right way, that would be like.
Big jump.
Or.
Big jump.
That's with no inversion, but doing an inversion.
Right next to each other.
Yeah, they're right next to each other. So you play little games with that between. You can often do things like the bass stays on one note, but the chord is moving because mm-hmm. those two chords happen to have a note in common, and it works for the bass to stay on one note, mm-hmm. even though the chords are changing. Just little like tricks like that. It's what I noticed the Beatles did that a lot when we were making By the Way. And so I just started getting really into like sort of tricking the ear of the listener by being clever with inversions and stuff.
Super cool. I can't remember the working title, but there's a song on the record called Roulette. Do you remember what the working title was?
Yeah. Yeah, so Roulette was that one that started here in the studio and in the other room where me and Chad and Flea were playing, and Flea's just playing like a funk bass line, like... He's playing some kind of funk groove, and then I was going... Yeah.
So this one came out of a jam in the room.
Yeah, so we were jamming, and Anthony came up to me, and he was like, what are those chords that you're doing? And I said, just Genesis-type chords, because that chord sequence that I'm doing, the reason I'm able to write something like that is because I've done a thorough study of Tony Banks' keyboard playing in Genesis, and I know his style pretty well. And so anytime I want, if somebody's playing, if the bass is just staying in one basic tonality, if the bass is just playing in one mode, one key, I can improvise chords all over the place really fast and stuff that modulate.
And that most guitar players wouldn't play, because it really is a keyboard technique.
It's a keyboard. Yeah, it's the mind of somebody who knows classical music really well.
Yes.
And understands that like most guitar players, you would never think if the bass player is playing, because that chord progression actually has a G major chord in it. You just wouldn't think if the bass player is centered on F sharp, you just wouldn't think that is one of the chords that you could play. But if it's got a flow to it, and it resolves in the right way, you can, you know, and that's what Tony Banks playing has taught me, that, you know.
That's even cooler, is that it's classical knowledge through a keyboard player transposed into guitar.
Yeah, I understand classical music better from learning Tony Banks stuff than I do from any other source.
It's amazing.
Know? Yeah. He makes those types of modulations so apparently simple sounding, you know.
And do you think he's doing it, if you're guessing, that it's an intellectual thought, or it's just, this sounds good, like, I just know how to play and this is what I would play? Or do you think it's like a computation?
Well, he definitely developed the style gradually, like the very first Genesis singles, he's not playing that way yet. He was really into Keith Emerson from the Nice, who was doing classical things in 66. He was starting to incorporate 67, he was starting to incorporate like classical ideas into a rock framework, and Tony Banks just wound up with his own way of doing it. But Genesis had for a while, they're a progressive band, but then they had hits where he's still playing in that kind of style. He just really figured out how to, of all the progressive bands, Genesis, I think, made the best pop music when they decided to go pop, you know, and he just had a really good mind for figuring out how to simplify things that are very complicated, you know, or that used to be complicated before he did what he did to them, you know.
Yeah.
Like something like, they had a hit, this song called Turn It On Again, that goes... He's changing keys, but the bass isn't changing keys. It's so fucking cool. And it's just an example. That song's in an odd time signature. The keyboard's modulating, the bass is not. This was a huge hit when I was a kid. When I was 12 years old, I heard it on the radio. I was like, whoa, what is that feeling? You know, I never heard that feeling in a song before. Yeah. At the same time, my dad was a classical pianist, so I had a reference point for it, you know. But that music spoke to just everybody, you know.
It's interesting when the complex can be presented in a simple form and compete with something simple.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's interesting. And I wonder if the people who are making this are trying to make something complex sound simple, or if they're just playing music the way they hear it.
No, because Genesis made an effort to simplify, because when Peter Gabriel was in the group, and for the first couple albums after Peter Gabriel left the group, their music is intentionally complex and the songs are long, and there's no verse chorus verse type things, or very rarely is there, and they just made an effort to simplify, but he retained a lot of these aspects of the essence of his style, and he just made it work as pop music. But there was definitely a clear, it was definitely clear that he, at that point, he made an effort to simplify. But even in the progressive stuff, compared to Beethoven or something, it's simple. And he probably doesn't, I get the impression he doesn't think of his knowledge of classical music as being particularly broad, but mm-hmm. I think, you know, compared to someone like me, it is, you know. So yeah, all through that early Genesis, and I say early, I mean the Peter Gabriel era Genesis stuff, he's doing things in that same style as he does on that Turn It On Again song. It's just, but it's more long-winded. It's not as repetitive. It goes further.
We'll be back with the rest of Rick's conversation with John Frusciante after the break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with John Frusciante.
We'll just do one more song, and it's not a recent song, but it's a song I always loved of yours. I don't even know where it is.
Oh, can I... Well, we don't have to go over the chorus of that, but that roulette is, roulette has that chorus, but.
Show me.
That's another kind of modulation thing. Thank you. like the chorus, it, both halves of it end differently, but both feel like modulations. You think you're just doing a real simple chord progression that you've heard a zillion times, but you don't expect this chord to come in. And that takes it somewhere else that also you've heard a million times. But you don't expect them to be together, you know?
Yeah.
And then this time it ends differently. So again, it's because modulation is just, when I'm writing chord progressions, it's what's interesting to me, and especially that you can do it in a way that's, doesn't sound like you're trying to be fancy. David Bowie used to do it all the time in ways that were really simple. And so a lot of the time when I write songs, that's what's going to make me think that something's interesting.
It adds a dramatic layer to it.
Right.
That's really interesting. It reminds me of like 60s instrumental music.
Yeah. And at the same time, like punk songs, because they're all major chords a lot of the time, they're often doing modulations within themselves just because of which major chords they're sticking next to each other. Like, it's not like it's just a thing coming from progressive rock and people who understand classical music. Like that has a modulation you would expect. You would expect the G to be a natural G, but because it goes, that's a modulation right there. That last chord is a little like unexpected just because that's a Ramones song there. But I'm just showing how like three simple punk chords still have the modulation in them. You can do it in really simple ways. Yeah.
The other song I wanted to ask you about was the death song.
Oh, my song, Dying Song.
Yeah.
Right.
It's so good.
Yeah, again, it's because I'm listening to the Beatles all, that I'm seeing how to go take these chords that were strange that I might not have understood how to find a context for before that. I was starting to like see how to use them. They sound normal when you hear the flow of them,
yeah.
but there was a time when I would just be like, I don't know what to do with that chord, yeah. You know. After a while, I understood, oh, okay, if you're in a key a whole step lower than that and you're just playing a minor kind of predictable thing, that chord can work. And then augmented chord can be, yeah. So I don't know, I just that's written at the same time, I guess, as By the Way. Mm. It was like a four-track recording I'd made at that time. And you tried to get the Chili Peppers to do it, and I wouldn't do it.
I don't even remember.
Yeah. So we were.
Love that song.
Yeah, we were in the studio for By the Way, and you were like, "Why don't we do it in the band?" And I told you, like, "No, I have to keep my solo music separate from the band."
I remember this now.
Yeah, like.
Yeah, because it was like you wrote this beautiful song. You write beautiful songs for the band. I don't understand.
Yeah. No, but I for some reason I had it clear in my head that when I rejoined that, like, once I realized that I could write songs again, yeah. I was like, I'm going to keep my solo music separate. Like, stuff that I write for the band, like, basically it was anything I wrote lyrics to was my music.
I see.
So if I was inspired to write lyrics to something, I considered that my music. And if the idea was basically just a chord progression or just a melody or just a riff or whatever, then that was for the band. And if the band was writing a record, I generally wasn't writing lyrics. Like, lyrics were something I more did on tour.
Right.
Like because I wanted to make sure that the band got my best stuff, you know, while we were writing a record.
Yeah.
So, but that was written prior to having written By the Way, I guess.
I was also curious to see what the band version would sound like, which I never got to hear.
Yeah, I mean,
I have no idea what it would be
it
like.
It was sung in a kind of a high falsetto voice, so it didn't really seem like something that would be natural for Anthony, and you were saying, like, switch it to a different key. But it wasn't just like how I told you there was those certain bands that I didn't play along with their stuff. That wasn't so much that I thought it would be a good idea, to be honest. I was superstitious about it.
I see.
Like,
I understand.
It came to me that it would be a good idea to have a couple of things that you never play along with, since you play along with everything that you like. Just leave that breathing room for.
Yeah.
And it just felt like something inside me was telling me to do that.
I completely understand.
And it was the same with my solo music. It was like, to keep your head on straight, you should have this music that you do that's not a part of this machine.
Yes.
You know, that's not a part of this personality, these personalities, that's not a part of their career, that's not a part of, you know, that you should have a side of your musicality that's separate from all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, in retrospect, it turned out to be a good thing, because I had a writing path that never got like mushed up with the band in the way like some people, like when the songwriter sort of is the band.
Yeah, you never got lost in the band.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was a fear of that, and there was the desire to always know that I had a place that I could go that didn't have anything to do with all the things around being in a popular band. It was like having a little sacred temple or something, you know, just, and so like you could have never talked, like you tried, but like you would have never, no matter how much you tried, no matter how good your arguments would have been, nothing would have overridden.
I'm glad that that's the case.
Yeah. Cause I've been able to, you know, not everybody who's in a band is able to do that. I've been able to have a sort of a musical, several musical lives completely separate from the band, without that ever interfering with what I do with the band. I'm always able to, when I am playing with the band, I'm completely like immersed in it.
And it feels like now there've been cases where, like, My Cigarette is a song that started as a solo piece of music, I think.
That's actually Flea's song.
It is?
Yeah.
So how did that start? What do you remember of the story of that?
Flea made a drum beat on his phone, and then he played bass to it. And he played a synthesizer over it, and
so cool.
And so, yeah, because my plan was to have no drum machines, no synthesizers.
Yeah.
I just wanted to play guitar. Flea brought that in, and when we did it in the studio, I programmed all the drum machines and synths and stuff. But I'm basically doing just the better sounding version of what Flea's doing, kind of like what we were saying about Depeche Mode's earlier demos. It's just like I just programmed it more skillfully, made better synth sounds and stuff. But Flea played it on my DX7, and I was turning the sliders because I'd made a sound that I could sort of modulate in subtle ways while he was playing. So we were actually like both at the keyboard at the same time, him playing it and me moving the sliders when he did the basic what is it?
That's my son's favorite song on the album.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And so,
it's such a funny song. It's such an unusual song.
Yeah. Some of the synth overdubs were things I thought of, but even some of the overdubs were things like Flea was sitting here and he was like, what if you just have a part that does straight rhythm, just one note? And then I converted that into a synth part on the modular. But yeah, there were other drum machine things like Drown, or the drummer started, it used to be called Drown, and that started with drum machines at my house with me doing it.
And the Slow Rodeo song.
Slow Rodeo one also was drum machine at my house. But my studio got torn apart because I had to move out of my house just a couple of months into the writing. So I thought we would do a lot more of that, like do like weird electronic even after we'd written songs, my idea was that we would do a weird electronic version of it just to see what happens.
Yeah, and it could even be a part of the song.
Yeah, that you never know what you could wind up doing with make weird electronic demos. But we wound up, I wound up being basically homeless for the whole time we were making the record. So I didn't really have a studio. So I think those are the only songs Black Summer had a demo with a breakbeat.
Did it?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't think I ever heard that.
Yeah, you heard it when we were recording it. We listened to it and you talked to Chad. You talked to Chad about how to get the drums groove to be more like the breakbeat.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I have no recollection.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's like it literally happens in the moment, and then it's like it never happened.
I think we realized we were playing it too fast. Mm. I think the demo made us realize that we had to get into a funkier groove with it, and it's not a funk song, but it needs to have a sort of a funk groove at the core of it. And I think
also because we recorded like 50 songs,
yeah,
it was all hard. A blur.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I have these memories because I'd been living with them for longer than mm-hmm. you. Like Black Summer was the first thing I wrote for the.
But for still, like 50 new songs, it's impossible to grasp.
No,
you know,
I couldn't
just
get my head around
each other.
It was so weird because, like, normally making a record, even when we made Stadium, where we had, you know, maybe 30 songs or something, I was able, when I was playing guitar solos and overdubs, to go, okay, this will be the one that I do this little trick on. This will be the one that I play in this style on. You know, when you have less songs, you can cover all your bases and you know, like, okay, I've done this thing that I do on this one. I've done that thing that I do on this one. When with this album, there was no way for me to know what I had done. I couldn't tell if I'd even repeated myself. Like I had to.
No, it's so much information.
Yeah.
It's so much information.
Yeah. I was really relieved when I realized I hadn't played the same solo on two songs,
yeah.
you know, or done the same riff on two songs. Cause it was just too many to have your head around at once.
Yeah.
But
it's amazing.
Yeah.
I still can't believe Anthony wrote all those words.
I know. It was like 48 tunes.
Yeah. It'd be like, four or five normal albums.
Yeah. Yeah, that
it's
was unbelievable.
So much work. And the words are great. He did so good.
I kept expecting him to stop. And I kept wanting to stop the writing process earlier.
Yeah.
Like thinking, like, I don't want to overwhelm him. These are good songs.
Yes.
I want him to I want him to write lyrics to them. I don't want him to get overwhelmed. But we just kept writing more and more.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a big proponent of keep writing because you never know. Like, you never know when the best song is going to come. So if you stop, it's like they don't always come. You know, you've never written this many songs before.
Right.
So we know it doesn't always happen because it's never happened before.
Yeah.
But if they're coming, you got to get them.
Yeah.
Whether you decide to use them now or not, it's fine. But when they're coming, you got to get them.
Yeah.
Because you won't write the same songs at another time.
It's true.
You'll never write those songs again.
Yeah. It's something that's come from electronic music for me, though. Like, I used to think of it like you're talking about, you know?
Yeah.
And now I think of it like, kind of like what we started talking about. Like, I can make songs to order. You know, like when Anthony liked that one chord progression that we used for Roulette, just went in my room that night and wrote a chorus to it. Or, you know, or when I was thinking, I think we need another heavy song, and I wrote that Nerve Flip. Like I just felt like that sludgy kind of feel. I was like thinking about what we had, and I was like, we don't have anything like that. And I was listening to Flipper and stuff, and just like.
I just listened to Flipper the other day on my beach walk. It was so much fun.
Yeah. So electronic music, the fact that I can sit down and just start making breakbeats or just start programming a drum pattern, just start making synthesizer sounds, not parts necessarily, pretty soon a song just comes. I think of the guitar the same way, you know, like when I stopped writing, I honestly thought I was doing the best because I stopped writing songs like three times when we were writing these songs.
I remember.
And it was just like, I just felt that I was doing the best thing for Anthony to have the best, to give the songs the best chance of Anthony writing over them.
Yes.
And I had no idea that he would, you know, write 48 full sets of lyrics.
I remember even down
I thought
to
it would
the
be too many.
Where there were one or two left and he's just like, I got to get him. Like, I don't, he would say, he's like, I don't really have an idea, but he was so wanted to get everyone because he loved them.
It was so beautiful, and it was such a beautiful like outpouring from him, and the lyrics were so good. Like it wasn't like he'd done an assignment or something. There was like so much heart, so much self.
Yeah.
Like that's something for me as a rock songwriter. Like I've never been able to put my heart out there so much as Anthony does, to put myself out there to make myself vulnerable to that degree.
Yeah.
Some people might disagree, but that's where I feel like my shortcomings are as a lyricist of rock music. It's just like Anthony has this rare talent of being able, you're really in his head when you're hearing him. He's really putting himself out there for you and making himself
and
vulnerable.
Some of it's so heavy or so sad.
Sad.
It's unbelievable. And it's not a, it's real. It's like he's feeling it and we get to hear it. Like we get to hear what's in his head. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. When I started doing the backing vocals and really reading the lyrics as opposed to just hearing them more for, to hear what he's doing more so than what he's saying.
Yeah.
Whew, yeah, like it was intense. Like
got him in good shape for the road, though. You know, 5 months, whatever.
No, he's been kicking ass on the road. But yeah, do you know that Negative Trend record? That's Will Shatter's band before Flipper.
Yeah, I never heard it.
Oh my God.
Is it great?
Yeah, it's a single. Okay. It's really good. And
I'll check it.
His bass is so good in it, and the songs are so good. Really like top-notch punk songs on that.
I'll check it out. I remember the name Negative Trend, and I remember that they were like a popular band.
Yeah, that's his band before Flipper.
Yeah.
And yeah, his vibe is like all over it, and they're really good songs. One of the songs was covered by an LA artist, Rick, I think, covered Meat House.
Mm-hmm. I got to hang out with him in San Francisco. It was
Rick L. Rick?
No.
Will Shatter.
Will Shatter, yeah.
No, I know. Remember you used to tell me that I reminded you of him?
No.
You don't remember that?
No.
No, when you came over to my house, you brought the Flipper record with you, and you gave it to me, and you said, I used to have this friend that was in this band. He died. When I'm with you, I feel like I'm with him.
I see.
And that was all you said, and you wanted to see if I liked the record, and I put it on. I'd never heard it before, and I was like, I love this. This is great.
Yeah.
But I never knew what you were talking about, and I've always wondered, that thing that you were seeing in me that you related to him, was that gone by the time Californication?
I think so.
That was only me at that time, right?
I think so, yeah.
And is it just a spiritual thing, not a, it wasn't, was it something about how we looked? It had
nothing to do with physical.
Right.
Nothing physical.
Right.
It was more the energy.
Right. Yeah.
And it may have had to do with practices at the time.
No, because I wasn't doing heroin. I'd never done heroin at that time. See. Yeah.
I don't know. It was just an energetic feeling of just like that there was something else going on. Hard to explain.
Right.
Hard to explain.
Yeah, that shit that was going on in my head, then I'm sure other people experienced it, but it was really just impossible to explain to people what's happening.
Yeah.
Sometimes I used to think, like, you know, you get goose pimples like on your arm or sometimes on your head. It was like they were in my brain.
Yeah.
It was a really like strong reaction to everything, not just pictures. It was all kinds of things. It was really intelligent voices. It was those things like goose pimples in my brain. It was just these explosions of like movement of shadow and light and things like that, that had this form that not only did they inspire me when I was making music, but like when I made music, that changed the picture. So whatever I did changed the movement of the shadows, and you just had to sort of stay aligned with it. And it's one of the reasons that I was able to do something then that I've never really been able to do since, is play totally fucked up and wrong and have it sound right.
Yeah.
I could do it if I stayed in connection with that stuff, those patterns in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since, I regained all kinds of talents and more, but that was something I've never really been able to be that like out.
Yes.
And sound good.
Yes,
sound like I'm doing it on that first solo record of mine that you released.
Yeah.
And I've never been able to play like that since. Yeah. And he has that in his bass playing.
Yeah.
Like even on that Negative Trend stuff, these are punk songs with real clear chord progressions. He's playing wrong notes and they sound so right.
Yeah.
Like they sound so perfect. It would ruin the song if it didn't have them.
Yeah.
Just sometimes people have some tripped out
it's being
shit
connected
having to do
it
with
in
balance.
A different way.
Yeah.
It's a different connection. still, you're showing me examples today on the guitar where it seems like it shouldn't work.
Right.
You know, it's still, it doesn't make sense, yet in the context of the song, it sounds beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I look for stuff like that, but yeah, it's done with a much more organizational part of my brain than mm-hmm. what that was. That was just like, whoa, what's happening in my head? Okay.
And you think it's not luck, it's something else.
Oh, back then?
Yeah.
Luck is connected to whatever that was happening.
Luck is part of it, but it's not the whole story.
I'm saying whatever the power was that was putting, that made it possible for my head to be that way that it was then, has something to do with luck as well. It's like it controls the universe or mm-hmm. something, because I stayed connected to that thing all through the years of being on drugs. And there was one morning I woke up and it had always told me I was safe, that I could do anything and I'm not going to die. And I tested it. I came very close to dying many times, always got through it. Got close to being arrested many times, never had a fear of it, and never got arrested. There was one morning I woke up and the voice said, your luck's run out. If you go out and buy drugs today, you're going to get arrested. And I got arrested that day.
Wow.
Yeah. To be able to do something unintentional and random and have it just work out just because you're seeing something in your head or something has something to do with why some people go their whole lives and never break a bone and other people injure themselves all the time. All I know, I don't understand it. I just know there's some connection between whatever that was my state of mind was, those things that were happening in my head that I couldn't explain to anybody and that I still can't really explain. There's some connection between that and luck.
And I love the idea that it told you, like you had a sense of complete confidence when it was appropriate.
Yeah.
And it told you, it warned you.
Yeah.
And it was true. It was right.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
It's wild.
It was really weird.
There's so much we don't understand.
I know. There's one thing I've learned from all that I went through in that first half of my life that I can't explain, it's that I don't know anything.
No, none of us do. It's the mistake people make is that they think they know.
Yeah.
And we just don't know.
This is why whenever I hear people getting strongly opinionated about things, or if I've ever had the misfortune to go through a period where all of a sudden I've learned about some new subject and I'm getting cocky about it and stuff, I always know, I feel it in my heart, like, this is wrong. You sometimes have the illusion that you understand things, and it's really a mistake to believe, to take too much pride in that get too cocky about it, because you're just seeing a little fragment of the big picture, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's all we'll ever see. All we get to see is a little piece. And that little piece that we get to see is enough to keep us going.
Yeah. Yeah, you see what we all are seeing, everything we need to see to be, you know.
And it's like, I think it's like a magic trick where I don't know that if we knew how it worked, it'd be better.
No, I'm sure that it wouldn't be better. I'm sure it would be a lot worse, and worse than people could ever imagine. People strive their whole lives to try to
figure it out,
understand things, and there's no way I can say it other than straight to you, like that I saw the big picture of it several times. I was shown
I see.
And it's way worse.
Yeah.
Just like we tend to pick on certain things about the world as being imperfect.
Yeah.
And we don't know what imperfection is. Yes. It could be so much worse. Life. Yeah. It's so good. Life is so good.
I'm very thankful to be here.
Yeah, me too.
Thankful to be here.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful to be here with you. It's the best.
Yeah, I'm so thankful to be here with you too.
Well, I feel like we still aren't done, but we have to. we get to do another one of these days. It was so good. It's endless. You never know where it's gonna go.
Oh, thanks so much, Rick. Oh,
I love talking about stuff. I mean, I love hearing about the music stuff, but the tangents are so interesting. Like, I'll be up all night thinking about what we talked about.
Right.
I love it.
Awesome.
As you heard, Rick and John will be back with more conversations soon. In the meantime, if you haven't heard the other episodes in the series, make sure to check those out, including episodes with the rest of the band promoting Unlimited Love from back in April. You can hear all of our favorite Red Hot Chili Peppers songs on my playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, Jennifer Sanchez, our editor is Sophie Crane, our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like our show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to Musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
It all started with two federal agents who heard a rumor.
She mentions, well, there is this alleged murder to have taken place.
There was just one problem. They had no clue who the victim was.
We have to do our job, and we have to find out. Who did they kill?
It had been 15 years since this alleged murder. Was it still possible to unearth the truth?
I used to watch the Unsolved Mystery shows, and I often thought about calling because I was like, this is not right. How can a person get killed and no one knows anything?
I'm Jake Halpern. And this is Deep Cover, The Nameless Man. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to hear the entire season right now, ad-free, subscribe to Pushkin Plus on our Apple Podcast show page or on pushkin.fm/plus.